Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. We'll hear a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2016 documentary film Eva Hesse, directed by Marcy Begleiter. This program, presented in collaboration with Darger HQ, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, January 31st, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Darger HQ connects Nebraska contemporary artists to the world by creating collaborative working opportunities between local artists and national and international artists with related practices, and develops partnerships that benefit artists by providing a new means of support through combined private and nonprofit sources. Darger HQ also educates, enriches, and exposes the community to some of the most innovative contemporary art being produced today. The members of the panel will be Angie Sikora, instructor of fine arts at Creighton University, Nancy Friedemann Sanchez, an independent artist living between Lincoln, Nebraska and Brooklyn, New York, and co-director of Fiendish Plots in Lincoln, and David Helm, professor of fine arts at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The moderator will be Launa Bacon, chairman of the board of directors of Darger HQ. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Succumbing to cancer at age 34, Eva Hesse's short career established her as one of America's foremost post-war artists. Best known for spare sculptural works that helped establish the minimalist movement, Hesse was nevertheless a polymath working in multiple media. Eva Hesse is the first feature-length appreciation of the category-defying artist's life and work, told through journal entries, correspondence with mentor Saul LeWitt, and interviews with fellow artists, including Richard Serra, Robert Mangold, and Dan Graham. The documentary captures the vital work, but also the psychic struggles of an artist who, in the downtown New York art scene of the 1960s, was one of the few women to make art that was taken seriously in a field dominated by male pop artists and minimalists. A superstar in the art world, but little known outside, why does Eva Hesse continue to excite passions? This brilliant, gifted, and visionary woman of 1960s New York survives personal chaos while creating work that changes the profile of art history. Along with creating a significant and deeply influential body of work during her short life, her story overlaps some of the 20th century's most intriguing moments. Germany in the 1930s, New York's Jewish culture of immigration in the 1940s, and the art scene in Manhattan and Germany in the 1960s. Hesse, one of the most important 20th century artists, is finally revealed in this character-driven film, an emotionally gripping and inspiring journey with an artist of uncommon talent, a woman of extraordinary courage. Diana Martinez, education director at Film Streams, has written these notes about the artist Eva Hesse. Eva Hesse's legacy in the art world cannot be overstated. In a decade, she'd reinvigorated art, moving away from the aesthetic minimalism of her colleagues into abstract and voluptuous forms full of color and texture. Yet, despite her prominence, there have only been a handful of books about her work, and director Marcy Begleiter's Eva Hesse is the first feature-length documentary treatment of the extraordinary artist. Hesse's work is difficult, not just intellectually, but also emotionally. It is confounding and suffused with meaning. Furthermore, the materials she worked with, usually found objects or organic material, are fragile and some of her pieces are degrading quickly. Their ephemerality is heartbreaking. Even decades after her death, Hesse continues to challenge those who want to engage her work. Conservators have had to adopt new techniques and strategies for preserving her work. Scholars have shied away from book-length treatments of her life and work. In April 2016, Yale University Press published the definitive text of her journals. Like the rest of Hesse's work, the 900-plus page tome, which is missing a volume withheld by Hesse's sister, is overwhelming and taxing. Eva Hesse gives insight into the 1960s art world and the prodigious mind that created such haunting work. Using snippets from her journal, narrated by Selma Blair, the film paints a well-rounded portrait of the artist as a young woman, from her days as a student to her career as one of the foremost artists of the 20th century. Here now to introduce the program is Casey Logan, Deputy Director of Film Streams.
This is our first community development collaborative screening of 2017, so this is a great way to start off the year. In this respect, this is a great way to start off the year. So thank you so much for being here. And it's a really exciting year. It's a big year for Film Streams in a couple really special ways. This summer, we're going to be celebrating the 10th anniversary of this building, our home, the Ruth Sokoloff Theater, which we're really excited about. Pretty soon, we're going to be coming up on our 500,000th, I think that's how you say it, or half a millionth attendee for our programs. So that's pretty exciting. That's going to be happening in July as our 10th anniversary here. And then hopefully, as you've seen, work is underway to on our project to renovate and reopen the Dundee Theater, which we're hoping to do by the end of this year. So that is a very special project in a number of ways, not the least of which is that it's going to really allow us to enhance and grow our programs in some really special ways. So we have a lot to share this year. Please stay tuned. If you're not signed up for our e-newsletter, please sign up at filmstreams.org. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, the usual spots. So on to tonight. Have some thank yous to say as we get into tonight's program. I want to start off by thanking Amy Haney, who initiated the idea for tonight's screening and panel discussion. So thank you. And a big thank you to Darger HQ for being our collaborative partner on tonight's screening. Lana Bacon, the chair of Darger, is going to be joining us soon. She's going to be moderating the panel discussion after the show. So I want to share a little bit about Darger HQ for anyone that isn't familiar with the organization. Darger is an all-volunteer-run nonprofit comprised of artists, arts professionals, and community leaders. Darger creates collaborative working opportunities between local artists and national and international artists with related practices and develops partnerships that benefit artists by providing new means of support through combined private and nonprofit sources. So name for the 20th century artist Henry Darger, of course, is the subject of amazing documentary In the Realms of the Unreal. Darger is... Darger is about supporting is about exposing the world to important and innovative works of art from underrepresented contemporary visual artists and bringing to Nebraska the artwork of new and emerging artists from around the world. You can find their physical space at 1804 Vinton Street, their website at dargerhq.org. Their very cool online publication, Art Files of the Flatlanders, is at flatlanders.org, so please check out all of that. Also want to thank the Bemis Center for helping us spread the word about tonight's event. Thank you again. I want to thank our panelists that are going to be here talking about the film afterwards, Angie Sikora, Nancy Friedman Sanchez, and David Helm. Thank you for being here. Enjoy the show. Please stick around for the panel afterwards. And thanks.
Thank you so much for coming. Can everyone hear me? I just wanted to thank Amy Haney for recommending Darger HQ and Film Streams to partner up, and also the Robin Hill Charitable Fund of Omaha for underwriting this event. And I'll go ahead and do introductions, I guess. I'm Lana Bacon. I'm the founder and director of Darger HQ.
I'm Angie Sikora. I'm an instructor of sculpture at Creighton University.
I'm David Helm. I'm a sculpture professor at UNO.
I'm Nancy Friedman Sanchez, and I'm a visual artist.
All right, so we'll just have a short discussion here, and then we'll open it up for Q&A. Eva Hesse was a polymath, and she worked in multiple media. And as far as I know, the three of you also work in multiple media. I was wondering if you could kind of talk about how that works out in your practice, the ability to move from one media to another. So, Angie?
I will start. So I have a process-based studio practice that's very much so rooted in much of what the documentary discussed with Ava, is playing with materials and really allowing this sort of discovery with materials to unfold just through the process of making. So for me, I'm not bound to a certain type of material. It's really the sort of accumulation of materials and allowing forms to come about just through the process of making within my practice?
That's a really hard question. I'm dying here. I guess for me, the work seems to start with a concept, and then I start jumping from one material to the next, trying to figure out how to realize it. So an idea might begin like I envision Leonardo da Vinci and Lewis and Clark on a voyage together, and then I have to work through some drawings and read some books, and then jump to the computer, work on some 3D models, sometimes learn how to work with microprocessors, work with a table saw, cut some felt, melt some wax, all that kind of stuff, hoping that all these materials sort of transform into some kind of symbols that relate to the content of the work.
Well, my work is about cultural memory. I was born in Bogota, Colombia, and migrated to the U.S. as an adult. And my work is also, it comes from a feminist point of view, and just, it has a lot of narrative, and I draw from the cultural forms that come from Colombia, but I also speak of migration and from the ideas that surround living between two cultures, two languages. But I'll take it to Eva Hess. I think, and maybe that's why I was invited, I think the point of connection with her work is that I am aware and very much a feminist in my work. And I don't think, and because she was a product of her time and the feminist movement really exploded in the 70s, right after her death, that she did not consider herself a feminist. That was not something that interested her. And so that should answer that question.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Yep. In 1998, critic Kenneth Baker discussed how Hess's work were a reaction against the cold, repressive masculine geometries of minimalism. If the art was to be more liberating, it must come from a more human touch, or it'll be more handmade or organic. Would you agree with that assessment?
Within Ava's work?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you think about that when you are making your large-scale sculptures? Because you use a lot of man-made chemical material, but it's set about very organically. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. So within my work, this sort of process-based practice, which is a matter of exploration within the studio and experimenting with these materials that I find some sort of connection with, or finding specific materials that resonate with me. Going back to Ava's work, where she was going, I forget the name of the store in New York.
Plastics.
Yes, you know, where she was going and accumulating these discarded industrial materials. I source my materials in a very similar way, but I allow the materials to take on the form that they will. So I have so much manipulation and control of the material, but there's some sort of chance in the end of that of allowing the material to take on the form that it will. And that sort of truth to material that exists that I personally am interested in exploring within my work.
It seems to me like part of that's part of what she did, that contribution to separate herself from minimalism. But she changed the agenda completely too, whereas in terms of sort of exploring materials and experimenting, she opened some interesting doors, but she also allowed information to enter into the work that the minimalists never even wanted there. So at the same, you know, you describe the work as being feminine or tactile, but it also involved, subtle hints of memory, of, sort of the material speaking in a visceral way, becoming the material itself still being, sort of slightly symbolic of all the industrial things that the minimalists were in. So we're dealing with. So it's sort of like, okay, now we can economize an image. Did you use the word humanize?
I may have. I don't.
Okay. Well, that's a good word. I like that word. So it sort of humanizes it in some way because you get that sort of tactile sense of what she's doing and how she's manipulating these materials. But at the same time, you begin to engage in content that I think opened the door for other artists, like somebody like Martin Puryear, who was sort of a genius at combining material with hints of information.
Well, I think also, going back to your question, I think her work was very tied to the grid and to patriarchy, to that dominant ideology that was completely it was the imperial form. It was what Donald Judd used. It was all of the works of these artists that were, she became part of the boys group, but it's only in the last work where her sculpture leaves the grid. I mean, she is tied to that grid all the time. I do think, I made a note of this, that the work is always escaping but keeping in. And I think what it's escaping, I think that's where her memory is in, the memory of the war, the trauma, I would even tie it to the fear of maybe going crazy, like as her mom, being bipolar. I mean, I don't even know if being bipolar at the time was really diagnosed the way that we diagnose mental illness now. And I think at the same time, and it was keeping in, but it was escaping. And I think there's always that duality in that work. It's escaping the memory, escaping the past. And in the notes that she makes at the end, she says, escape the past, a new page, a new slate, post-divorce, a new page, post-tumor and post-surgery, a new page. And I think it's in that last piece where the grid, where patriarchy is left behind.
And I'll add to that on that note of the minimalists, I think having this very rigid, matter-of-fact answer to the formal qualities of the work within minimalism. Mm-hmm. And another note that I took where she stated that the work goes beyond what I know and what I can know. So there's that element of attachment to minimalist sensibilities, but right. Yet the human touch that removes it from this certain definite matter-of-factness, mm-hmm. of minimalism, that she really breaks away from that, which I think humanizes her work so much. Yeah.
Exactly. And in that way, a lot of people believe that Eva Hesse ushered in post-minimalism, which is a tendency. It's not actually a movement where, like you said, the use of minimalism is a starting point. But by utilizing everyday objects and simple materials, it's taking it kind of beyond, that sterile kind of grid. And one last question is, she talks a lot about the importance of play in making her work. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on how you utilize play in your studio or in your practice, and also what's the biggest influence that Hesse has had on your work?
Mm-hmm. So the idea of play, first and foremost, is the biggest influence for me. My work evolves through a number of small material studies where I am constantly looking for materials that inspire me. Various materials fill my studio space, and instead of drawing what, physically making drawings on paper, I draw with materials in space. So this idea of play is what really then leads to more realized, developed forms just through working through some of those ideas with materials.
boy, I don't really have much fun when I'm making my work. And I really, there are aspects of this film that I think maybe aren't, I love this film. And I think it's very important. I think a lot of the documentation of this work is important for everybody to see. But my understanding of Eva was that she was really tormented, you know, so at the end when she starts talking about play and the work is playful, the work is liberating in some way, but I just sort of feel like internally in that studio practice when she writes in her journals about how hard it is, how hard it is to be a woman in the art world in the 60s and 70s and how hard it is to, you know, break ground, it doesn't feel like that's what I would think of as play. On the other hand, you know, I don't. There's a very fine line between when I work in my studio and what I do as a professional artist and what I do as an educator. And the first thing that I would encourage my students in my classes to do is experiment with materials, see what they're made of, see what kind of information they provide for the viewer, and play with them and see what comes out of that. So I don't know if that's the answer to the question, but it's an attempt.
I would say for me, I mean, and I wouldn't say that it's a lesson from Eva Hesse. I would say it's a lesson from me to me. It's the commitment to do. To just do it, to not judge it, and to play, and to go forth and do it. And I do think she was extremely lucky and to have the desire to look inside and push herself to do. I will add, I think she was willing to not take the path of her mother and to do therapy. I mean, and I think therapy was, I mean, it allowed her to look in, and that it was kind of like in and out, just think, process, and make the work, and commit, and play.
Very nice.
Can I add something?
Of course.
Please. So one of the things that I think that the movie doesn't capture all that well is the time that she was in Germany was the period in her life where she made this transition from her two-dimensional work to her three-dimensional work as a result of having access to this material, these new materials, and having the time. It's like, you know, she was on a residency, so she didn't have all this other stuff to do, so she could sort of engage in that freedom of experimentation and playfulness.
One of the pieces that she looked at and was super influential in her work was seeing Duchamp's The Bride and the Bachelors. And when you look at her paintings, you see that many of the works are, and also Jean Tinguely. So she was looking at these machine pieces and The Bride and the Bachelors, which are kind of these visually or graphically mechanic pieces put together. And if you see her paintings and her initial drawings, they're kind of these contained forms, and I would say it's even parallel to kind of like each grid in a grid, each particle in a grid, like the one in 100, and they all come together, and I think it has to do with that sense of chaos that is controlled, that is compartmentalized.
Wonderful. Thank you. I guess we'll open it up to questions for the audience.
Did she have any contact with Louise Bourgeois? Do we know?
I don't know. Thanks.
That's an excellent question. You can't help but wonder the similarity. There's so many similarities between the two.
I can't remember when they began to dig out Louise Bourgeois, because, you know, she wasn't shown for so long.
Yeah.
Right, but she was working during that time.
Definitely.
In New York, so.
Right. And Ana Mendieta.
True.
As well.
Mm. Yeah. I don't know. Thank you.
Well, and Jackie Windsor, right, who she was a peer of, and I think they crossed paths at some point in time.
Yeah.
And but this is all pre-identity politics. So, but you can see the roots of that coming along.
I also wonder, because I've thought a lot about that, where's Louise Bourgeois in all this in terms of relevant female sculptors in the 20th century. But I also wonder where Rauschenberg was in this whole thing, because he had his approach to just experimentation and breaking boundaries was so powerful, and he must have preceded her by, what, a decade or so. Mm-hmm. So I can't help but that didn't help her break through all the hard edge masculine minimalism. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to make a few comments about playing with the work, because when you are playing with it, you kind of gravitate in certain ideas and things that you're involved with, and like you said, the different mediums, you kind of put things together. And so when she's doing that, she's putting herself into that work. Everything is coming to a fruition. And the other thing that I thought was really interesting was when she smashed the glass. And about the artwork, you know, it may go back to dust, but she just threw the glass. And she said it was life or something like that, but it was like saying that no matter what, you know, evolves that artwork, that it's a part of her and it's going on, you know, even if it's dust in the end or shattered glass. So that was just my thought.
Mm-hmm. Well, that story is also reminiscent of Duchamp's discovery of the large glass when it was opened in the crate and it was broken, mm-hmm. Right?
Right.
It's done.
How do you guys relate to the work on, when I, especially seeing this film, it crystallized a lot of what I've thought about everything she's done, especially from the middle to the last part of everything, of all of her sculpture, is that there is a kind of a performative aspect to it. When you see that the final product, it feels like you get the whole process, because everything that she mushed into there, she hung, she let the gravity, she let the materials take hold, she let everything take hold in that. And I think there's a lot of artwork today that gives credit to that remnant of the work. And she kind of alludes to this, how the process is so important. When she breaks the glass, when she says, screw the collectors, screw the institutions, they'll have to deal with it. And I think she really beautifully puts that in her art, and she does free it up, because so much of art is about not freeing it up, is to make something that you can sell or blah, blah, blah. And she's so good at not doing that. And I wondered how each of you has to respond to that.
I mean, in my own practice, when I first started making, I was making very formal compositions out of steel. And that was the only material I was working with at the time, which I enjoyed very much, but was also very limiting. And there was this permanence to it that I had to deal with. You know, where does it go when it doesn't have a collector who is purchasing it? So the type of work I'm making now is almost a response to very early work of my own, where I didn't want that permanence. I want to be able to roll my works up and put them under my arm and take them to a gallery and install them. And they're now these grand gestures that don't have to be grand because they're these traditional permanent materials, whether it be steel, stone, bronze, which has this long legacy in sculpture. So for me, I take that away very much so from Hesse's work. And her response to that is it doesn't need to be this permanent thing. Mm-hmm.
I think it's essential in my work as well as what I think is good work to see information that's a result of the process.
I mean, I don't know. I think she's a product of her time, of a group of artists that was doing works in a very kind of Dada kind of way, and not thinking of selling. And many of them didn't sell. It was also just historically such a different place. I don't entirely connect, even in the use of materials, because I'm more of the product of identity politics, where the materials have an inherent meaning. And she would use latex, and she would use fiberglass, and she would use all of these materials at the time artists were not pressed to explain what was the meaning of fiberglass. What was important was the shape that they were creating. And so you see in Ring Around the Rosie, it looks like a breast. It has a psychosexual content. And that is what, for that time, was important. Psychoanalysis, I think, was beginning to be very important for artists. And so I see a distance between my own practice and her practice. I can think of an artist like Mike Kelly, who I think is influenced by her, as are many artists influenced by those proto-feminists and feminist artists. And even in Mike Kelly, you already think of the inherent meaning of the materials that he's using, the stuffed animals, it has a direct reference to childhood, to religion, to different aspects of life. And I don't think that happens in Eva Hesse's materials.
I also think you have to remember that I think the way you're talking about it, Charlie, is that it's the process of how the piece is made. Is that right? The process really starts way before that. I mean, in her work, and you were saying, you know, that there's something very formal about using this grid. I mean, she came up through Cooper Union, went to Yale, so she's really classically trained, and she's a prolific writer and a prolific reader, and all that becomes part of, you know, what is built into the work that you never see. You don't see it until the movie comes out, right?
Yeah, she comes out of Clement Greenberg.
Right.
And all of that, the art for art's sake. So she breaks through, I think, through psychoanalysis. I mean, that's my interpretation.
We should all be in therapy.
you had mentioned Anna Mendieta's, who was married to Carl Andre, who is considered the father of minimalism. Do you agree with that? And also, have you ever read the book Naked by the Window, which was written about their life and Anna's death, which was attributed to Carl, as in he threw her off the balcony? Anyway, Anna was my little sister in college. And in the art department. I just wondering whether you think of him as being that, and both of them, both Eva and Carl, as being in the same, they obviously knew each other. Did they know, was Anna around at that point? Do you have any idea? And you've never read the book Naked by the Window, because it really deals with women in art in New York at that period.
I was really fascinated by her attending that workshop on modern industrial processes and art, and the continuum between science and art. And I'm wondering if any of you are adopting some of the modern technological scientific processes to your sculpture or your art?
I think artists these days do marketing workshops. Yes. Well, for example, Creative Capital has a whole program of doing workshops for artists to survive in the marketplace.
That program was experiments in art and technology, and it coupled. I'm trying to remember who else was part of it. I know Rauschenberg did a really interesting Mud Muse piece as a result of that. Oldenburg did the moving ice bag that eventually got caught in its own machine. I don't know if you remember this story, but the acronym for experiments in art and technology was EAT, and it ate itself, so that became the sort of icon for the project. But those projects are really important, and they should do that. They should be doing that all over the place, because we don't have the I'm turning 60 in a couple of weeks. I can't learn computer programming very fast. It takes me hours and hours, and if I could collaborate with somebody who knew it, I could move forward much faster in terms of being able to use that in a creative way. So it's unfortunate that, you know, it's kind of crawl along.
For me personally, I don't use any digital technologies in my work at all. I'm very much a proponent of truth to material, so I don't even like to artificially introduce color via paint to any of my materials that I'm using. So for me, I try to keep the material in its most true state that I find it in. The manipulation comes through the use of my hands, so even tools in my material, the interaction of tools with my materials, I keep fairly minimal as well. I will use like scissors at most sometimes. So,
hello. I just wanted your thoughts on, it seemed like for someone who liked to journal so much and provide so much context, it seemed like she also had a lack of desire to classify anything as herself as an artist, when it talked about her not wanting to classify herself as a painter or a sculptor. She was just an artist. And then also with her work, she just called it absurd, ridiculous. It said something like non-forms, non-plan, non-art, non-nothing. And I just wondered your thoughts on that idea of non-classification.
I personally believe that she very much so understood herself to be an artist. But in terms of the non-classification, I think that goes back to, once again, this is a note I wrote that I want to reference, but where she talks about the art was in the making and the object was the artifact. And I think that really comes into place in terms of her not wanting to label the work, because when she starts to label it, it becomes specific. It may take on representational sort of meanings within the forms. So for me personally, that's my understanding of her not wanting to label the work, is to leave the making within the process, and then the art being this thing that exists as the result of that. And so by not labeling it, it's the interpretation of the viewer to then bring a meaning and association to these absurd forms that she's creating.
I think part of that is her attempt to really distinguish herself from all the other stuff that's going on around her, and just continually trying to make that effort to find that new thing. One of the things, the other thing aside from Carl Andre that irritated me was Richard Serra. And at the beginning of the movie, he says, as you say about the 60s, he says, you know, there was no art world. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. I'm wondering what an art historian, I'm looking at Nick over here, what an art historian would think about that, because my sense is up until maybe about 10 or 15 years ago, there was a very specific art world in place. You know, we went through abstract expressionism, then we got to minimalism, conceptual art, process art, earthwork art. Then we got to, you said, post-minimalism was not a movement, but I think post-minimalism is a movement. And then we get into the whole postmodern era. And so you always know, you know, she was reacting against what preceded her, and you always sort of know what that is. And I think what's really difficult right now, and particularly in a town like Omaha, where you don't have a sort of, you don't have the Chicago imagists here, you know, the Omaha imagists or the Omaha abstractionists. So you don't know what to react against. And as a young artist, that's really important. We got out of graduate school and I don't even want to tell you when, but it was a long time ago, and it was in Chicago, and it was very clear what we were reacting against at the time, and part of that was the commercialization of the art. Okay, so it was in the 80s, the commercialization of the art world, and that became the next birth of installation art because it couldn't be collected, it couldn't be commercialized. So I think that's kind of part of what she was after that happened up until fairly recently.
Well, Lucy Lippard refers to minimalism as a kind of fascism. And I can't but think that Eva Hess was a survivor of fascism and a survivor of the Holocaust. So there's always an effort of escaping. And she's a survivor. So she creates a work that completely escapes the grid, escapes that Greenbergian paradigm that was so dominant that basically it was a dogma. Artists had to be, it's like you had to be a minimalist or there was no way that you would get a show. And she escapes that and creates her own unique imagery. I mean, think of that. It's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. And then she's able to enter that world and be part of it at the same time. It's remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Angie, David, and Nancy. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. We've heard a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2016 documentary film Eva Hesse, directed by Marcy Begleiter. This program, presented in collaboration with Darger HQ, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, January 31st, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The members of the panel were Angie Sikora, instructor of fine arts at Creighton University, Nancy Friedemann Sanchez, an independent artist living between Lincoln, Nebraska, and Brooklyn, New York, and co-director of Fiendish Plots in Lincoln, and David Helm, professor of fine arts at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The moderator was Launa Bacon, chairman of the board of directors of Darger HQ. Special thanks to Patrick Kinney of Film Streams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next event in the Film Streams Community Development Program will be tomorrow evening, Tuesday, March 7th at 7 o'clock. At that time, there will be a special screening of the 2016 documentary film Chicken People, directed by Nicole Lucas-Hames, presented in collaboration with Big Muddy Urban Farm. The film will be followed by a panel discussion about community agriculture, featuring local community experts in farming, city code, and animal husbandry. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.